Do steroid injections help with carpal tunnel?
What's the evidence for screening for peripheral arterial disease?
How often do rotator cuff injuries occur and what should we do about them?
And are we overdiagnosing thyroid cancer?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
And in full disclosure to our listeners, as always, we're recording from France, where you unfortunately broke your clavicle the first day and are not doing any cycling at all, but consuming lots of French food.
I don't only get to enjoy the cycling, but I do get to still enjoy the French food and French wine. You're absolutely right, Elizabeth.
Yeah, and using wine in preference to other means of pain control, as I understand it. Let's turn then to what we're going to talk about this week. Why don't we talk first about the Journal of the American Medical Association, a provocative study where you've educated me a little bit on rotator cuff injuries and how often they occur and what should we do about them?
This issue of shoulder pain is the third most common musculoskeletal reason that people seek medical care. At any one time, it affects somewhere between 7 and 26% of adults. In this particular study, did a meta-analysis to identify the most common, actually the most accurate, clinical exam findings for rotator cuff disease, because this is a diagnosis that can be confirmed with imaging, but should be able to be made in a general practitioner's office. And they found 28 different studies that assess the different examinations of referred patients by specialists. This is orthopedists. And the basis of this, the authors are able to recommend 5 very simple tests, one that involves the elicitation of pain and the others that examine the strength of the shoulder. And with these tests, one can reasonably well establish whether someone has rotator cuff disease. Now, Elizabeth, rather than go into each of the description of the tests, because people are going to want to say, well, which test is it and how do I do it? One of the things that I really most enjoyed about this article is it had terrific pictures and terrific figures that showed exactly what those 5 physical exam findings are. These are exams that can be mastered by general clinicians and even the lay individuals to find out if they have rotator cuff disease. So I'm going to suggest that we post this particular article on our blog.
All right. Well, because you have already, as I said, educated me that this problem is so much more common than what I would have ever guessed. I mean, I really thought it was limited to pitchers, and I thought that's why you were picking it this time. I definitely will talk about this on the blog. But let's just return then to this idea of rotator cuff injury. What can people do about it?
A lot of these injuries occur as a result of falls, so preventing falls can be very helpful. Many of them occur just as a part of the aging process, and that is for people under the age of 30, about 1 in 40 can have rotator cuff disease. Over the age of 70, it's as much as 1 in 7 individuals. So one of the ways we can prevent these is to do exercises that strengthen these particular 4 muscle groups.
So prevention then is the best strategy.
Absolutely. But once it does occur, most of these injuries are treated conservatively. Surgery is only done in extreme cases. Even many complete rotator cuff tears can be treated successfully conservatively.
Okay, well, that's good news then. So for all those folks out there I didn't know about, then we're going to refer them to this article. Let's turn then to something else that's interesting in that it's extremely common. That's thyroid cancer. In the British Medical Journal, a study looking at the overdiagnosis of thyroid cancer.
This gets to the issue that we've talked before with regard to prostate cancers. This particular article is an analysis that's looked at what's happened with both cancer screening, cancer diagnosis, and more importantly, cancer mortality over the last 30 years. And what they determined was, for example, in the United States, the incidence of thyroid cancer has tripled over the last 30 years, making it now one of the fastest growing diagnoses. However, the mortality has not changed at all. Thyroid cancer surgery has gone up 60%, radiation therapy has gone up 300%, but perhaps we're treating cancers that would never cause problems to begin with.
Okay, so we know that we're finding these things incidentally often because people are having exams for other reasons, and then, oops, we see this thing, and oh no, now we got to follow it up. What do we know right now about the natural history of thyroid nodules?
If you just do an autopsy study, you'd find that a third of people who died from other causes actually had thyroid cancer. It was usually pretty small. Cancers that are very small, less than 5 millimeters, certainly less than 20 millimeters, oftentimes don't cause problems. And in the absence of a positive family history or evidence of metastasis or a large tumor, oftentimes they don't cause issues at all. So as a result, these authors are recommending that we don't do routine screening for thyroid cancers. that it be limited to people that either have symptoms or have a large detectable nodule on exam.
So we can avoid the screening aspect of it, but what do we do about these incidentalomas?
Well, if you just do MRI or CT scans of the neck, 16% of them have small incidental findings in the thyroid. What the authors are recommending is, unless there's a family history or unless it's large, that we really shouldn't do anything about it other than to perhaps observe it. If it grows larger, then it could be addressed.
Okay, let's leave that one then. Now let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine since we're talking about screening. The recommendations of the USPSTF on screening for peripheral arterial disease or PAD.
All right, for those that may not be familiar, the USPSTF is the United States Preventive Services Task Force. It's a group that is supposed to be unbiased and independent that really looks at the literature and assesses treatments or various screening techniques. And in this particular one, they assess the utility of doing screening for peripheral arterial disease or atherosclerosis in the blood vessels to the lower extremities, to the legs. And why this is important is because if individuals are determined to have peripheral arterial disease, they have a 2- to 4-fold increased risk of having cardiovascular disease. So let's take people that are asymptomatic. Let's determine if they have peripheral arterial disease. If they do, that identifies a high-risk group, maybe we should treat them more intensively. But when they looked at the data, 96% of individuals that have peripheral arterial disease have one of these four risk factors: smoking, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or diabetes. This already puts those individuals at a higher risk for cardiovascular disease, and those risk factors need to be addressed. Based on the current literature, routine screening of asymptomatic individuals does not give any more information than routine risk screening with those things that I mentioned. Furthermore, low-dose aspirin did not prevent cardiovascular events. All it did was increase the risk of major bleeding. So on the basis of this, the USPSTF concludes that the current evidence is insufficient to recommend routine screening or routine treatment of asymptomatic people for peripheral arterial disease.
Just say no. Finally, then, let's turn to another article in Annals of Internal Medicine, steroid injection. Oh, are we even going to talk about that with everything that's been going on for that? And carpal tunnel syndrome, very common condition that people who work at computers all day develop.
And that's an entrapment of the ulnar nerve as it travels underneath the tendon of the wrist. This is called the carpal tunnel. In people that have irritation of this nerve or inflammation, it can result in pain and tingling in the fingers and actually weakness in the affected hand. Now, the most common treatment initially is wrist splinting, and it can be very effective. But when it's not, the real question is, does steroid injections help? More importantly, can it prevent surgery? So this is a randomized placebo-controlled trial of 111 patients. They're randomized to one of three groups. So these were all patients that had initially had wrist treatment and it wasn't successful. A third of them got injection with placebo. A third got injection with 40 milligrams of dexamethasone, a steroid. And a third got a higher dose, 80 milligrams of dexamethasone. And they assessed their symptoms at 10 weeks, and then assessed how many patients required surgery over the subsequent year. And what they determined was that the patients who received the steroid injections, and by the way, neither the physician nor the patient knew which they were getting, steroid or placebo, had better symptom relief at 10 weeks. But at 1 year, a lot of the effects had worn off. They weren't very durable. And in fact, 3 out of 4 patients ultimately needed surgery nevertheless.
Sounds like an awful lot of these steroid injection strategies that just postpone eventual more, shall I call it, definitive treatment of the condition.
You know, I think you can look at the study in one of two ways, kind of the half glass full, half glass empty. You can say, well, gosh, the results of steroids were short term. Or you can say, gosh, the use of steroids prevented 1 in 4 surgeries. You know, we're doing a lot of carpal tunnel surgery, and perhaps that's not such a bad way to look at it either. So I agree with you. Depending upon what your perspective is, determines how you're going to view this particular study results.
And I guess it comes down again to the individual patient. If they would like to give it a try and see if they can avoid surgery altogether, fabulous. And if not, at least they can postpone it a little bit.
That's one of the values of looking at these studies critically, is you can tell the patient, gosh, we'll give you the steroid injection, and there's a 1 out of 4 chance it could avoid surgery, or it may not. And on the basis of that, the individuals can be involved in that decision-making process. So that's why I thought it was important that our listeners know whether steroids can be helpful and durable in patients with carpal tunnel syndrome.
Excellent. We're going to end with that. I wish you safe travels to Italy. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.